31 Palestinians overnight, including four minors from various occupied West Bank districts, said the Palestinian Prisoner Society, PPS, and security sources. Israeli forces detained 10 Palestinians from Tul Karam district, 7 from Jerusalem, 7 from Hebron district, 3 from Jenin, 2 from Ramallah district, and 1 from Bethlehem, and another from Jericho district, according to the local news agency Wafa. Moreover, a group of Israeli extremists prevented Palestinian children from going to school in Hebron City on Thursday, the director of the Palestinian Authority's Ministry of Education Hebron office, Basim Tahboub, said. Tahboub told local media that Anat Cohen, a well-known extremist who frequently harassed Palestinian residents in the area, first attacked the school children, preventing them from reaching Kutaba Middle School. Following Cohen's initial attack, other extremists reportedly joined in and began cursing and scaring the children. Instead of attempting to continue to school, the children decided to turn back and head home, Tahboub said. Children who attend Kutaba school, aged between 7 and 16, are often harassed by settlers in the area, as the school is adjacent to the illegal Israeli settlement of Beit Hadassah in the center of Hebron City. Hebron's city center is home to some 800 notoriously aggressive Israeli settlers who live under the protection of thousands of Israeli forces, surrounded by more than 30,000 Palestinians.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan, Martin Dodge, Ryan Pritchard, and Joe Meyer. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Emily Young.
And I'm Robert Barncord. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it'll be Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting, the topic will be Ending Racist, Sexist, and Anti-Queer Violence Necessitates Speaking Up With and For Sex Workers. Ani and Lynn will talk with Red and Camille, representatives from Portland's Sex Worker Outreach Project. At 9, we'll hear the first of two programs honoring the life of activist, poet, and musician John Trudell. We'll hear For Future Generations, which is a talk with poetry recorded in Portland in 1998. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And at 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Paul Rowland hosts Part 2 of our special on the late John Trudell with a combination of spoken word and music. Thanks to all of you KBOO members for your generous support for community radio. It's not too late to become a member this year or renew your membership. Just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. And stay tuned now for an interview conducted by KBOO reporter Robin Ryan with an environmental activist who is on the ground in Paris for the climate talks.
A reworked draft of outcomes achieved at the climate conference in Paris, France, was issued today after an earlier version released Wednesday failed to draw adequate support. The latest accord runs 27 pages long and covers alterations made to the body of existing agreements obtained during prior climate conferences. David Turnbull with Oil Change International has been part of the delegation at the conference since late last month. He spoke with KBOO reporter Robin Ryan about the developments with negotiators, as well as the impact of several demonstrations that have been staged in the area since the conference began.
Can you share with our listeners what the primary differences between the document that was released Wednesday night and just now?
We're still going through it by the minute here, but the coordinator of the negotiations said the attempt was to try to come to some sort of narrowing of the options for all of the different sticking points. There are still a number of sticking points in the negotiations, in the text, around the level of ambition for the longer-term goal of the agreement, as well as how the effort for meeting that goal is going to be shared, as well as how finance from rich countries is going to be leveraged to help developing countries meet their effort as well. So there's a lot still at play, but we're starting to get closer and closer to an outcome here in Paris.
With the conference scheduled to conclude in the next 48 hours or so, what would you estimate has been the most pivotal moment thus far, and what aspect of the negotiations does it concern?
I think there have been a few pivotal moments, both in the negotiations and outside the negotiations. So I'll start with the outside. There have been a number of different events that have taken place where civil society has really shown the power of the climate movement around the world. Just yesterday, there was a sit-in, actually, in the halls of the negotiations where a cross-civil society gathering really showed the solidarity of the entire movement for climate action. It was an incredibly powerful moment and an incredibly powerful action with chants for greater climate justice and more ambition were echoing throughout the halls. It was really powerful, and I was lucky enough to be a part of it. So that is a really great example of just how animated and how forceful civil society has been here in Paris. Inside the negotiations, there have been a number of different pivotal points, I think. One has been the increasing number of countries that have actually suggested that the global maximum temperature goal of 2 degrees Celsius that had previously been agreed at in previous years is actually too high. Small island states in particular have consistently said that 2 degrees Celsius of warming is really, really dangerous for them and perhaps even dangerous to their entire existence as nation. And so the call for a new maximum level of global warming at 1.5 degrees Celsius has really gained traction, and even countries like the U.S. and Canada and Australia have come on board with the idea that this needs to be considered. There's a lot of work to go to actually make it a reality, but you know, that's been a really interesting and exciting development, I think, here at the negotiations.
I know that as the conference began, 24 climate activists were placed under house arrest. Would you say that there's been a response from the remainder of the movement?
Yes, I think there has been, and I think it's been a positive response. I think the entire climate movement was troubled by sort of preemptive arrest and house arrest by the French police. Obviously, it's a very challenging and sensitive time here in Paris after the terrorist attack, and no one wants to do anything that's going to cause any sort of harm or any sort of challenges for the response to those attacks. And that's never been the intention of civil society and the climate movement in planning actions. And so there was a lot of concern about those arrests. But in response and looking forward, the movement has done some really, I think, interesting things. On the weekend before the talks began, there was a human chain that lined the streets of Paris that was just simply beautiful. I took part with a number of my colleagues and friends, and it was a really wonderful way to respond to the restrictions that the Paris French police had placed on gatherings and on action in a way that was both creative and pushed the boundaries a bit, but also really positive. It was a great way to set the tone for the negotiations. And then inside the negotiations, there's been a number of wonderful actions to really raise some heat and some noise in the corridors of the negotiations themselves. And those have been received, I think, quite positively as well. And as we head into the final days here, there is already talk of a response in the streets of Paris the day after the negotiations are set to end that is going to be strong and it's going to be very powerful. And it's going to, again, push the boundaries of what the French police are saying is acceptable to really show that we're serious about the need to take robust action on climate change, the need to listen to the people on the streets, and the need for our voices to be heard. So I think the restrictions, they've been rough, but at the same time, I think the climate movement has been finding ways to ensure that the voices of the people are heard.
I see reports from the conference and a consistent reference to something called loss and damage. Can you share with our listeners which aspect of the negotiations this phrase applies to?
So loss and damage is this concept that even in the past year has really gained traction within the negotiations, again, thanks to the small island states and other vulnerable countries that have been raising it quite vociferously. The idea is that there are going to be losses and damages associated with climate change that people, communities, and nations can simply not adapt to. And there needs to be plans in place for how to deal with that as a global community. And so what these vulnerable countries are saying is that they need support in a variety of different ways, not necessarily financial, but all sorts of different ways to be supported in dealing with things like mass migration of communities that are inundated by sea level rise, or dealing with entire communities just simply not being inhabitable in the future. And this is something that's a really tough issue to be even thinking about, but it's reality. And thankfully, the negotiations have been proceeding on this idea and this concept. There's a lot of tension around exactly how it's discussed and how it's dealt with in the negotiations. The United States and some other developed countries in particular have concerns around whether they are seen as liable from a legal standpoint for damages that they would then need to be paying. But what's clear is that the actual vulnerable countries are not necessarily looking for that per se. They're looking for support to make sure that their communities and their citizens are taken care of, and that when we move forward into this new climate changed world, that their countries and their people are going to be able to continue living in a way that's respectful.
How agreeable do the developed nations seem to be on the expectation of providing $100 billion annually to address climate change? Is there a set of guidelines as to how those funds are to be spent and on who?
There is a new body that was created in previous negotiations called the Green Climate Fund that has been created to really manage and deal with the dispersal of climate change related funds that are going to support developing countries in order to adapt and take action on climate change. And there is a lot of very specific and detailed negotiations within that fund, that body, that really helps to try to determine what the best way to use those funds. But at the end of the day, the developing countries that are dealing with the impacts of climate change on their soil and trying to take action to leapfrog from their technologies now to the advanced renewable technologies, they do have a good sense of how to do that. And there's a lot of capacity there. More capacity needs to be built, and that's part of the discussions here. But really, the first need is simply to be sure that that support is there. And of course, there will be a lot of work done to ensure that that support is used in the most effective manner. And I think that that's being done. But we need to be sure that coming out of Paris, there's a clear understanding that that support is going to be there moving forward. And it's important for all of us, because developing countries are going to be hit hardest and fastest by climate change. And that those impacts affect us all when it comes to increased conflicts or resource scarcity that is causing strife, and simply because we're a global community and we need to be supporting each other.
At the outset of the conference, there was a lot of concern about how much corporate influence was going to be visible and what kind of impact that presence would have on the conference. Do you think those concerns have been realized?
The oil industry in particular, but all of the fossil fuel industry, always seems to have an outsized influence on the negotiations and on climate policy around the world, and particularly, of course, in the U.S. The way it sort of manifests itself at the negotiations, it's less clear sometimes. There are some countries that have oil industry representatives on their own negotiations because they have state-owned enterprises that are the fossil fuel industry, and so it's a part of the government. And those countries, like, say, Saudi Arabia, have consistently blocked agreements, blocked ambition, blocked new steps on climate change in ways that have been really problematic. What's exciting and what's important in this conference here is the amount that civil society has pushed back in an incredibly strong way. We're winning this fight, and the climate movement is winning and notching up big wins all around the world, whether it's stopping the Keystone Pipeline or whether it's pushing Shell out of the Arctic and North America. We're winning the fight against big oil, and the negotiations are continuing to move forward, as evidenced by the consensus that's emerging around the need to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. We're starting to see greater and greater ambition move and creep into the negotiations. Certainly not nearly enough, but we're definitely moving in the right direction, and the influence of the industry is definitely lessening.
I'm sure when your organization made plans to head to Paris and attend this conference, you had some goals of your own. Can you talk about what those goals have been and how well they've been met?
We at Oil Change International focus quite specifically on the issue of subsidies to the fossil fuel industry, and these are borne out in national budgets. So the U.S. providing billions of dollars a year for the production of fossil fuels domestically, but also in the international context, providing public finance for fossil fuel projects around the world. So we've been here at the negotiations in Paris with a very clear and simple message, which is stop funding fossils. It's simple, it's clear, and basically what it means is that if we really are serious about tackling the climate crisis, we can't be digging the hole deeper with one hand as we're trying to climb out of it with the other. So we've been here raising that message and saying stop funding fossils in all of the places that we can possibly say it. And it's resonating. It's become quite a meme. It's quite a theme of a lot of discussion here. And I think it's a concept that is gaining a lot of traction. There are a few specific paragraphs in the negotiations where the concept is essentially found. But even more importantly, perhaps, is just the buzz around the negotiations and within governments and civil society that this idea that public support should not be going towards the fossil fuel industry is an important one and is one that we need to take action on immediately. We've been actually quite excited about the attention that the Stop Funding Fossils movement has been able to garner, and we're excited to move forward with the campaign as we enter into 2016.
For folks listening to the conversation that we've been having and wanting more information, is there a website you might refer them to?
To get involved with the Stop Funding Fossils movement, you can go to stopfundingfossils.org.
I've been talking with David Turnbull. He is the campaigns director at Oil Change International from the ground in Paris at the climate conference. For more information, you can visit their website at priceofoil.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KABU News.